And we'll move to our last case this morning, United States versus Michael Yumong. Yes, please. Good morning, Mr. Jensen.
Attorney Jeffrey Jensen, Sr. appears on behalf of the appellant Michael Yumeng. Mr. Yumeng was indicted in the Eastern District on several drug counts. He eventually waived his right to a jury, so the case would be tried to the court. And shortly before the start of trial, the government provided us with a letter that one of the drug analysts had been the subject of a performance improvement plan, which I will not refer to as a PIP, I promise.
Thank you.
I've had that lecture before. A performance improvement plan. And simultaneously, the government applied for, and we didn't object to, protective order that prohibited us from disclosing that information to third parties. So the case gets called for trial, and analyst A, that's the person you've been referring to, testified, and on cross-examination, I, who was the trial lawyer, wanted to cross-examine her about her performance improvement plan. But because of the protective order, I approached sidebar and asked the court to give me some guidance on the contours of this protective order. And rather than doing that, the judge said, "I'm not allowing you to cross-examine the witness on that information, because it's not relevant." So then I didn't. At some point after that, there was a break in the proceedings, and it was suggested that we should put the contents of that sidebar on the record. And I asked the question, are we doing this in open court, or are we closing the courtroom? Again, attempting to get the contours of this protective order. And at that point, the government moved to close the courtroom. And for reasons which I will never know, I failed to object to the order closing the courtroom. The arguments in the ruling were placed on the record. And so that leaves us with two issues on appeal. One, I think, is much simpler, so I'll briefly discuss that. And that has to do with whether the performance improvement plan was relevant evidence and should have been admitted. Now, I fully acknowledge that the standard of review on appeal recognizes that the district court has vast discretion in admitting evidence. So it's a rare, rare time where you're going to be able to prove that the judge abused his discretion in excluding evidence. But I think this is one of those cases, because the reason the judge gave was that the performance improvement plan was after this person did the drug test in this case. And I think that's important because it doesn't make any sense, because the analyst's work is very likely to be much better after the performance improvement plan than it was before. That was my argument. I believe that establishes that there was an abuse of discretion, because it simply doesn't make sense. So I want to move on to the more difficult issue, which was whether Mr. Yumeng had his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial violated when the judge ordered that the courtroom be...
Counsel, let me ask you the antecedent question.
Sure.
Do you think sidebar conversations are themselves a violation of the public trial clause?
I have argued in a different context that they are. I know for sure, based on my research in this case, that they violate the rules, because the judges are supposed to...
No, the rules require the judge to make sure that there's a court reporter present, and that rule was violated. I'm asking whether the sidebar conversation itself violates the public trial clause. In most criminal trials, the judge will hold sidebars that are sotto voce, preventing the jurors and the people in the courtroom from hearing what's going on. My question is, does that violate the Constitution? If it does, then your argument follows. If it does not, then your argument does not follow. So does it violate the Constitution? Are district judges violating the public trial clause every day in criminal trials? That's the question.
And the answer to the question is yes. I've made that exact argument in other cases, primarily in state court.
You ever won in a federal court of appeals on that argument?
I have not, Your Honor. No, but the question to me was, do I think it violates the...
I didn't really ask you if you thought. I asked you if it does.
Yes, it does. It does, Your Honor. Because the defendant is not present in the sense that he cannot hear the conversation that's going on between the judge and the lawyer.
He is not the public for this purpose. The people in the audience can never hear the conversation at a sidebar.
That's the purpose of the sidebar.
Sometimes, indeed, judges use machines that muffle the sound and prevent anybody in the audience from hearing it.
Then I'll change my answer. I don't think it does. What I was thinking of was the defendant's right to be present during all critical stages.
That's not the public trial question.
Right. I misunderstood the question. So the answer to this issue, I think, lies in this dissonance that I think exists between Walton versus Briley, which was a 2003 case in which the Seventh Circuit said that this is a fundamental right and it can only be waived on the record knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. So therefore, the lawyer's failure to object in that case didn't matter. And United States versus Anderson, which is, I think, a 2018 case in which the Seventh Circuit acknowledged Walton versus Briley, did not overrule it, but just said it doesn't apply in Anderson because under the plain error analysis, he can't meet prongs one and two because it was a trivial violation.
Let me ask you, Mr. Jensen, a question about that particular time frame, because you were present. It's the before the description of the sidebar. You ask, quote, should we do it in open court or should we seal the court? That's from page 155 of the transcript. The transcript won't reveal whether that statement was being made by you to Judge Stadtmiller, whether it was being made to the government, whether it was being made to the, so people in the audience might know that there's an issue. The reason I ask is it could go to the invited error question. Your comments on that?
Well, if you're asking me to tell you outside the record who it was said to, and I don't know if Mr. Funnell was there. I don't think he was there, but it was said to the judge. It was directed to the court. You know, I was asking, you know, what are the contours of this protective order? Because in the last few years, there's been this proliferation of protective orders in federal court. And it's always in the back of your mind, well, am I going to inadvertently violate a protective order? I think that's what I was asking.
It's somewhat surreal because we're in a bench trial. And I can't imagine this courtroom was packed.
Well, I don't remember who was in the courtroom, but that was my reason for asking it. That I didn't want to divulge that information in a public setting without the court allowing me to do so.
Reagan.
So back to this dissonance between Walton versus Briley and Anderson. Walton never talked about the plain error rule. But I think if you did apply the plain error rule to Walton, it meets all of the criteria. There was an error. It was very obvious. It affected the defendant's substantial rights because it involved the fundamental right to a public trial, and it made a difference. This is the government in their reply or their responsive brief argued that the violation here was trivial, and it was not trivial because unlike in both Walton and Anderson, the closure was done accidentally. In other words, the proceedings went past 5 o'clock when the courthouse was no longer open. Here, there was a motion by the government and an order by the judge closing the courtroom. So that was not trivial, and it should have been obvious. and it affected a fundamental right for Mr. Yumeng. And therefore, I think even if we apply the plain error rule, Mr. Yumeng still succeeds. And I reserve 2 minutes for my rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Funnell.
Good morning, Tim Funnell for the government. I was not the trial counsel in this case. That was two of my other colleagues. It was down here in the Milwaukee office. As has been indicated here, there are two issues that Mr. Yumeng raises. One of them is that the district court's 5-minute courtroom closure during which no evidence was introduced amounts to a public trial violation. The second issue is the district court's discretionary ruling limiting cross-examination of the analyst. I think it's important to point out that the analyst was one of three analysts that the government produced in this case. The government, in our brief, we put together a summary chart at page 4 that puts together the seizures of the methamphetamine, the different dates that they occurred, as well as the different analysts that tested those substances. And as you can see, the chemist that we're talking about here was with regard to the evidence that was seized in 2019. She did not testify as to the other evidence that was seized. We believe that a straightforward application of Gaia and the invited error doctrine, as well as Anderson and the plain error analysis, govern this case. We think that the court, or at least as to the courtroom closure issue, we think the court can look to both of those cases and in a very straightforward application of invited error and plain error, reject the defendant's argument about the public trial violation. Judge Easterbrook, in regard to your question about the sidebars and whether that is an implication of the public trial right, the cases suggest, I don't know that there's a case directly holding that those are exempt from the public trial right, but they certainly suggest that those types of sidebars are routine and that they are likely not subject to the public trial right. This court in the plain error analysis could look to those cases and decide there was not clear and obvious error. The court could, in its decision in this case, make a definitive statement about sidebar conferences. And regrettably, this conference was not recorded. We certainly acknowledge that. It was the government's counsel that then made the suggestion, we need to put that on the record, which then at defense counsel's suggestion resulted in the closure. I'd like to back up chronologically, however, to discuss how the information came to defense counsel, because that impacts how we get to a protective order and a courtroom closure. The bench trial started on June 10th. On May 23rd, so some 17 days before trial, the government reaches out to defense counsel, and this is in the record in the motion for protective order. And we indicate we have potential Giglio information about one of our witnesses. We're going to disclose that to you. We would like to move for a protective order first because it concerns information that's arguably protected by the Privacy Act. Defense counsel did not object to that. So we filed that motion for a protective order on May 23rd. It was not ruled on by the district court until May 31st, but we're still some 10 days before trial or thereabouts. As soon as the district court entered that protective order, which was, by the way, a provisional order, it still allowed defense counsel to disclose the information as ordered by the court. So that could have been a litigated issue as to whether that information should have remained confidential or not. It was not. So on May 31st, the protective order gets entered And we immediately provided the information, the plan, I'll call it, about the chemist, the performance improvement plan. We provided that to defense counsel. So we're still 10 days before trial. Defense counsel makes the decision not to raise that in a motion in limine prior to trial. If that had been done, the need for a closure of the court during the trial could have been avoided altogether. And that feeds into our argument about invited error. It's not just what happened at the trial, it's what happened that led up to those events at the trial that we think are so relevant to the invited error doctrine. If you look at the Gaia decision, where this court dealt with the potential structural violation of the deprivation of counsel during an overnight recess, Gaia clearly holds that structural errors are still subject to invited error. They can be waived. And unlike, it doesn't have to be a personal waiver of the defendant, it can result from the conduct of the defense. And in Gaia, after a discussion about structural error, the history of structural error, Judge Posner in Gaia said, we don't have to run that hair to the ground. This was invited error because it resulted from what the court said was the continued harping by defense counsel about the phone records. Defense counsel had objected to the government's attempted cross-examination in Gaia. And they put the onus, Gaia puts the onus on defense counsel to some extent, that if there is some sort of ambiguity, which the Gaia court said that the judge's order in that case was rich in ambiguity, if there is such ambiguity, it really is up to the defense to clarify that and not to do it after hours, as the lawyer in Gaia tried to do, but do it right then and there so that they can get some clarification. Had they gotten that clarification, they could have avoided the deprivation of counsel overnight. The same thing applies here. Not only do we have the events at trial, but we have the events before trial, and the onus could be on defense counsel, as we argue it should be, that the government armed you with the information that you needed or wanted potentially to cross-examine this chemist. It is then up to defense counsel to decide the procedure. And here, defense counsel, by waiting until trial, realized it's still pursuant to the protective order. I shouldn't just talk about it in open court. To his credit, defense counsel realized that. So they asked for the confidential sidebar. The sidebar then, of course, is not recorded. And then we fast forward to later in the trial when we try and get that memorialized for the record. And the trial judge makes clear his ruling is about relevance. So we think that there's invited error here. We also think that there's plain error. We rely primarily on Anderson. Anderson involved presentation.
You think there is not plain error?
Oh, I'm sorry. The plain error standard of review applies. Yes, thank you, Your Honor, for clarifying. We think that plain error review governs here and that the defense has not overcome that test. In Anderson, the amount of evidence that was presented during the time that the courthouse was closed, and Walton makes clear it doesn't matter whether it was intentional or not. So we don't believe that that point is impactful here. But there were three witnesses. There was part of the defense's argument, closing argument, the government's entire rebuttal argument, the charging conference, and the reception of the verdict. All of that occurred in Anderson during the time that the courthouse doors were locked, and this court held that to be a trivial error. If those facts in Anderson are a trivial error, certainly here where we're talking about a 5-minute courtroom closure during which no evidence was introduced is also trivial. We look at whether that error infected the entire framework of the trial. That's supposed to be the rubric about assessing the effect of a public trial violation. And certainly that is not the case here. This trial took place in the public eye over the course of 2 days, except for 5 minutes, during which not a single witness testified. No evidence was introduced. That is a trivial error. Looking at the second issue, the district court's discretionary decision, not only did the district court say that the analyst's proficiency plan from 2023, I'm sorry, I see that my time is up. Just to finish that thought, the 2019 material is when she tested the substances. We provided the defense with material showing that for 10 years up until 2023, she tested proficiently. So that definitively disproves the defense's speculative theory about how she must have been proficient, she must not have been proficient previously. With that, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jensen, you had, I think, 19 seconds left, but okay. I'll give you a minute to amplify your rebuttal.
I've been doing this long enough to say that I'm completely used to prosecutors arguing that anything that goes wrong in a trial is the fault of the defense lawyer, and I can take it. However, this argument that by not making a motion in limine and by asking for guidance from the judge concerning the contours of his order, I invited the error, that goes way too far. If you want to back up this line of causation, then I can argue it's the government's fault for getting a protective order for everything under the sun and making us having to deal with it.
I could ask a practical question here. This case wasn't defended on the nature of the substance in question. There was no question that this was meth. And so the forensic chemist's affirmation of that fact really wasn't a fact of consequence here. It had to be put on the record in the bench trial. But your conduct admitted multiple times that this was meth. And talked about the quantities and so forth. And then his defense was that this was personal quantity because he had a heavy habit and he was a user, not, and said he wasn't a dealer.
Well,
so I'm not quite sure why this relevance ruling was really consequential at all.
Because
that bears on the plain error standard.
Because at the time, Mr. Yumeng had not testified. That was in the government's case. And I think the government always has the burden of proving every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
And to continue your argument, then, the timing of the Giglio, whether we look at the day itself or the 10 days before or the 3 months before, can affect the back and forth and the invited error.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and that concludes our calendar for today. The court is in recess.